tell you a quick story here as we start, because these will be some pictures that you will not see on PowerPoint. But Gary just reminded me, he says, do you remember what you were doing last week about this time? Well, Israel is 7 hours ahead of what we are now, so it's 4:30 in the afternoon or so. He says, you were floating in the Dead Sea. Well, that's right. That was on Sunday evening that we did that. And so some were asking some questions about, what is that like? Well, kind of gooey. The water is a different consistency. And it's real easy to float. I mean, if you get out in the water about this deep, which is a challenge, because the water's not the problem, but the soil, it's a muddy muck, kind of like slippery clay. And so getting out into the water, to me, was not incredibly pleasant. It was kind of gross, really. And getting out into the water, once you got out about that deep, you could just kind of roll backwards and you just float. I mean, it's like you couldn't sink, which was like really, really weird, because usually when I'm in water, I'm like a rock. You know, I have to work hard to get up on the top. But you would have to work real hard to get under the water in the Dead Sea. The salt, and I can't remember this, Gary, maybe you remember, that the salt consistency was like 23%. Is that right? 23%. Now, you know, in the ocean, it's about 3%. You know, it's a little bit easier to swim in the ocean than in fresh water. But in the Dead Sea, you just float. And so, I mean, you don't want to put your head underwater. That would not be pleasant. And you don't want to splash your eyes, do you, Gary?
No.
No. You don't want to splash your eyes. It's an unpleasant experience if you splash your eyes. Gary will tell you all about that. But you can, when we got out there and we floated around, some of us did for about an hour. And, I mean, you didn't get tired at all because you weren't swimming. You were just floating. And even when we got out in water deep enough, some of us were standing up straight, so to speak, in the water. Our feet were not touching the ground. How deep it was. I couldn't get down to the bottom anywhere. But we were just floating, standing up, which was, I mean, you kind of kept wanting to float your feet back up. You had to work to get your balance to stay straight like that, which was really weird. And if your feet started to come up, you didn't want to roll forward and face plant into that water. That would be unpleasant. You'd want to roll to your back. And so that's just a little bit about the Dead Sea. We'll tell you more about the muck another time, the mud around it and stuff. But that's what we were doing about a week ago at this time. But right now we're in Nehemiah chapter 4. That's where we're going. And so we've kind of worked through these first three chapters here as the children of Israel, some of them, a remnant has come back to Jerusalem. In fact, we saw a little bit of the wall, Nehemiah's wall, in the city of Jerusalem, a portion that has been uncovered, that was not fully rebuilt, I guess. And that goes back to the days of Nehemiah. And I do have some pictures of that somewhere. Someday if I can sort through the 2,000 pictures that I've got, maybe I can find that and show you that. But anyway, the wall is being rebuilt here in Nehemiah chapter 4. When we looked at chapter 3 in our last studies, you know, we were encouraged and amazed at the way that the people were working together so well. And a lot was being accomplished. Neighbor was working with neighbor, so to speak. And I get the picture that the wall was just all the way around. There was those people working. And the wall was being built where it was halfway up, the text would say. Oh, but there's some opposition that comes. There always is. I mean, any effort for good, any effort in the way of God will come with opposition. The most well-meaning plans will meet with obstacles. We all know that. Just in life as a whole, the most well-meaning plan will meet with obstacles. But in particular, if you're doing the will of God, there are those who work against you. They're working against God, really. But if you're on God's side, they're working against you. And that's what Nehemiah and the other workers are about to experience here. And then when what you are doing works against the ideals of the foe, which in this case is Sanballat and some others who are the enemies of Israel, well, they're going to rear up. We've already seen that already in the text. Well, they kind of come back again now with greater force. And Sanballat, it seems, has collected some of his friends, you know, to come and work with him. I mean, these are old-time enemies of the Jews, and they are very much opposed to the rebuilding of Jerusalem. And so they're basically mobilizing their armies, so to speak, against those who are working on the walls, even ready to fight for this. They're ready to fight Nehemiah. You know, you have to oppose something a whole lot to be willing to fight against that. And that's where they were at. They were willing to fight against these things. Now, Nehemiah, well, he has already demonstrated his faith in God. And he has demonstrated to those who are workers, to those in Jerusalem, and has been able to rally the troops, so to speak, and has them working. And but in time, as we go through this lesson, we find that they are going to have to, Nehemiah is going to arrange the men to be able to work both day and night, because now time is of the essence, because there is opposition. And they're going to have to work against this opposition. You know, it takes a certain passion to be able to do that. I mean, to work against a foe, to work against one who is an enemy, you have to be very set on what you're doing to stand up against an enemy. And we see that with not just Nehemiah, but others who are working on the wall. And so there's just a real intense focus on what needs to be done and a will to get it done. Sometimes it almost seems like we need some opposition to kind of make our faith be increased and to really get a good focus on what we need to do. And I'm not saying we should be praying for opposition necessarily, but we can see here in the case of Nehemiah and those working on the walls that when they faced opposition, it seems like they worked all the harder. And it's not because they were fresh or relaxed in any way. They were tired and wore out. And now they had the concern of, as the story goes on, the concern of being killed because of the work that they were doing. And so they would need great faith. They would need faith that would increase, in fact, to continue to do the work that they are doing. Now, as we get into chapter 4, I guess the best way I can think of to describe the opposition that they are going to face is ridicule and derision. Those are powerful tools. You know, it doesn't take old men to figure that out. Children figure that out, don't they? I mean, when children pick on each other sometime and ridicule and mock, they make fun of one another, it's a powerful tool. It can stop progress in anything that's good when that happens. And that's exactly the powerful tools that are going to be used against Nehemiah and the workers. No one enjoys being made fun of. And in these first few verses of chapter 4, well, that's exactly what Sanballat and Tobiah, they're basically making fun of the children of Israel in a hope and in an effort of stopping the progress that they've made here, you know, on the wall. And so we will see as we go through that unless they can refocus, unless they can just get focused fully on the task at hand, Sanballat could be successful. He could bring to a stop the work that's been done so far. But we'll see what happens. Nehemiah chapter 4, verse 1. But it so happened when Sanballat heard that we were rebuilding the wall, he was furious and very indignant, and he mocked the Jews. And he spoke before his brethren in the army of Samaria and said, "What are these feeble Jews doing? Will they fortify themselves? Will they offer sacrifices? Will they complete it in a day? Will they revive the stones from the heaps of rubble, stones that are burned?" Now Tobiah the Ammonite was beside him, and he said, "Whatever they build, even if a fox goes up on it, he will break down their stone wall." Verse 4, "Hear, O God, for we are despised. Turn their reproach on their own heads and give them as plunder to the land of captivity. Do not cover their iniquity and do not let their sin be blotted out from before you, for they have provoked you to anger before the builders." So we built the wall, and the entire wall was joined together up to half its height, for the people had a mind to work. Interesting introduction here into this chapter, and really this is the text for this morning. I want us to really look at these verses here and see what we can learn from these. If you're looking at your worksheet there, some of the things for us to consider. You know, we said already, God's work never goes without opposition. And in this case, it's Sanballat who is providing the opposition. And he has help. He's not alone. There are others that are his cronies standing there with him, you know, making fun of the children of Israel. Well, give me some answers on this. What was the purpose of the comments Sanballat made? What's he doing?
Trying to discourage the work so that they'll stop.
Discourage. Kind of cut their feet off. You know, just take away the foundation of what they're doing. What else would you say?
Intimidation.
Absolutely. I mean, pretty powerful tool. I mean, it still works today. And you know, we've already seen this with Sanballat some, but now he's come back with greater forces, and he's coming back again, you know, to just see what he can do to stop building this wall. What else would you say? What do we see? What's happening? What's his purpose? Go ahead, Harry. That's right. That's right. Like this, it's like, this will never work. Even as Tobiah speaks up and says, well, even if they build the wall, even if a fox jumps on it, it'll fall down. You know, as though they were, you know, inept at what they were doing. James.
He might have been trying to build up the army of Samaria that tells them, don't be afraid of these fools.
Yeah. They don't know what they're doing. Look how foolish they are thinking they can even rebuild this wall. Yeah, we can see here what he's trying to accomplish. And you know what? To some degree, you would have to say that history is on Sanballat's side. You know what I mean? I mean, for years, they have not managed to rebuild the wall. And so he can kind of play on that some, too. And he is. And so you have to think of all of these things. We try sometimes to put ourselves in the same shoes or sandals that they are wearing and understand kind of what was it that brought them to this point, and what arguments can Sanballat and Tobiah and others like that make that would stop the progress.
They don't want to criticize their efforts. They criticize their building materials. They say, how can they resurrect these stones that have been burned?
Yeah. Yeah.
But it
cast doubt.
Plants a seed. Can we
yeah.
Do this with the materials that we have?
Yeah, should we keep on building? Is the wall going to fall? If a fox jumps on this, is the wall going to fall down?
Maybe implied here, I'm not sure what they're building with, but limestone, when you burn it, turns to lime. Mm-hmm. And dust. Mm-hmm. The calcite that binds it together. Same thing with some forms of sandstone.
Mm-hmm. There is truth to that. And limestone and sandstone is what they had. I mean, that's what the walls were built of, and still is what the walls are built of. Good points. That's right. So, again, we're saying history is on the side of those who are persecuting. You know, they're relying on what has happened here for years. The wall's not been rebuilt. It's been stopped before. Maybe by a few unkind words, they can stop it again.
The American Standard Version translates it that he spoke in the presence of his brothers and the wealthy men of Samaria.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
commerce.
Center, mm-hmm. Source, a business center,
Sure.
Infrastructure in Judah.
This could affect them financially even. So there's all kinds of reasons here, right? Well, but what we really see in this is that Sanballat was pretty good at what he was doing, at trying to stop the progress of this wall by whatever means. And ridicule was a pretty powerful tool that he was using now. You know, critics demoralize. Have you noticed that? And effectively so. Critics can so often accomplish whatever they want to accomplish, which is usually not something good, by being very critical and demoralizing those who are working on something that's good. And that's what Sanballat was so good. I mean, he made fun of the Jews in front of others. Can you imagine, as he and Tobiah were talking about, well, even if they build the wall and a fox jumps on it, it'll fall down. Ha, ha, ha. How do you feel now when you're working on that wall? You know, and that's what Nehemiah and what the Jews were dealing with. Well, in verses 4 through 6, there's an interesting prayer made by Nehemiah. And I've struggled a little bit on just trying to understand how to deal with this prayer. Can we look at it again here for just a moment? Hear, O our God, for we are despised. Turn their reproach on their own heads. Give them as plunder to the land of captivity. Do not cover their iniquity, and do not let their sin be blotted out before you, for they have provoked you to anger before the builder. Interesting prayer, isn't it? Now, I want us to think about that for just a moment. You know, how do you explain that kind of praying? I mean, particularly if you compare that to what Jesus said about prayer. I mean, if you think about Matthew chapter 5, you might look there for a second. Remember in Matthew chapter 5 when Jesus basically gave us some instruction about prayer? Matthew chapter 5 and verse 43 beginning, and attitudes here that we should have even against our enemies. For you have heard that it has been said, you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I say to you, love your enemies, bless those who curse you, do good to those who hate you, and pray for those who spitefully use you and persecute you. Well, compare that to Nehemiah's prayer. Now, what do you say? I mean, how do you explain the praying here of Nehemiah when compared to even how Jesus would pray and his attitude toward his enemies?
Well, we're all understanding that, yes, we pray for our enemies every day. We're trying to hinder us. But it's just like, you know, judge, shall not judge. It's what judgment needs to be used against you. Mm-hmm. And we pray that they'll have a change of heart, change of mind. What Nehemiah is praying here is, don't let them allow the work to stop that you have charged us with.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're doing what is right and just. So don't allow these enemies. And if it means that those enemies need to be destroyed, then so be it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's just like today. You know, when we pray for those that are in the workplace, or whatever, those that have lost us for our faith, we pray that they'll have a change of heart.
But may will their efforts be defeated?
Yes, their efforts be defeated.
Yeah. James? It was a strict law in that way. Of course, it would still teach love, too. But here again, Nehemiah is looking for the efforts of his enemies to be defeated because he's working on the side of God. Neil?
I wonder if this was praying in the presence of everyone, too, as a reminder to them. We've got an ally.
That's a good point. And, you know, I don't know that we can really, we don't know that. But it's an interesting point, and you wonder, you know, is that something that Nehemiah would have prayed in front of the others?
Well, even Jesus taught that if you go to your brother who has sinned against you and he doesn't listen to you, mm-hmm. and then he doesn't listen to other brethren, mm-hmm. then the response is to treat him as a heathen and a publican. There comes a time when somebody who is not willing to submit to God's will is to be treated differently than someone who has
very
not
true.
Had the opportunity to do that.
That's right. Very true. Bless.
Mm-hmm. Which is sort of asking God to have revenge upon his own enemies, which is what Nehemiah is
yes.
saying here. He's not saying we want to go after them. Mm-hmm. He's saying they have offended you and your work. Therefore, let them be accountable for their sins.
I think that's a bigger picture of it.
Mm-hmm. What they're doing.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
he's asking for justice because they are mocking God, not just them. They're mocking God.
Remember, it's already been identified that God is on Nehemiah's side, that God has given to his hand what he needs to accomplish his will. And so that's already been, in fact, that's what has given those working on the wall such strength and encouragement, I think, is to know that the grace of God is on their side. You know, as Nehemiah had said. And I think this prayer is just a continuation of that thought or theme. You know, God, if you are on our side, then defeat our enemies. You know, is the idea here. But still, it just kind of strikes me as peculiar. You know, when you hear this prayer of this godly man who is asking God to bring, you know, wrath upon his enemies. Well, let's understand why. I mean, as we've read through the story, we can see that and we can understand that God is on Nehemiah's side and those rebuilding the wall, that God has promised his blessings on them. And it's like Nehemiah is saying, don't let our enemy take us. You know, you take care of the enemy, we'll build the wall, is more or less what he's saying with that. Don't let our enemies succeed in doing evil. You know, anxiety can be diminished greatly. You know, when we turn to God for help, according to his will. You know, when we are facing enemies, just like Nehemiah was, when there are those who are ridiculing our faith, when there are those who are trying everything that they can to destroy our faith, we find strength in God. And we find here, once again, Nehemiah turning to God in prayer, you know, for help, for direction, for strength, even for the defeat of enemies that would be against the will of God. And what we keep saying as we go through, lessons learned. And we see many in the book of Nehemiah. There's a lot of lessons learned that way. You know, even in the face of evil, here on the bottom of the page, even in the face of ridicule, you know, the opposition that they were facing, the people continued to work. I thought that was an interesting point. That after we see in these first six verses, you know, that there was opposition, there was ridicule. The enemy was at hand. Nehemiah prays to God, whether that was publicly or privately, we don't know. But in verse 6, it's just interesting here that it just makes the point, so we built the wall, and the entire wall was joined together up to half its height, and the people had a mind to work. I mean, they were focused on this. And maybe it took a little bit of a reminder of their purpose to help them keep their mind where it needs to be, that they had a mind to work. If you think back here, go back to chapter 2. We're back in Nehemiah again. Nehemiah chapter 2, just a couple of points that we've made earlier on, you know, or that the text has made earlier on. Chapter 2, verse 18. Remember back to this portion when Nehemiah had come to Jerusalem, had surveyed the walls, and now standing before the people there in Jerusalem. He says, and I told them of the hand of my God, which had been good upon me, and also of the king's words that he has spoken to me. So they said, let us rise up and build. And then they set their hands to do this good work. I mean, they started that way. And even now, in chapter 4, they still had a heart to work. That hasn't changed, you know, even with the opposition. In the New Testament, in Colossians chapter 3, Colossians chapter 3, the Apostle Paul makes a statement here that I think should be helpful to us. Again, we're thinking here about the idea of just getting our hearts set on what we should do. Colossians chapter 3 and verse 23, he says to those who are Christians, he says, "And whatever you do, do it heartily as to the Lord and not to men, knowing that from the Lord you will receive the reward of the inheritance, for you serve the Lord Christ." It's almost like a reminder of, you know, like you say to your kids sometimes, you know, remember who you are. It's like Paul is saying that to the Christians. Remember who you are. Remember who you serve. You know, you serve the Lord Christ. And with that in mind, whatever you're doing with regard to the will of God, do it wholeheartedly. Put everything you have into it. Be focused on that. Remember who you are. And that's what kind of comes to mind there to me, you know, with Nehemiah. And that may be a little bit of what's happening now in Jerusalem as well. You know, because now there's a greater fervency. Well, I should say greater fervency. It's been pretty fervent so far. But now maybe there's like a refocus here, that even as there are those who have come and basically said, no, you can't do that. You can't get it done. You'll never make it alive, you know, kind of attitude. They're just totally refocused now. And we see that as the story goes on. On page 10, on the back of the page here, practical applications we're talking about. As we go through the story, we keep kind of going back here to just, you know, lessons learned. What does this mean to you and me? What can we learn from Nehemiah where we can make application now, you know, in this life? And we're still considering here these first few verses of Nehemiah chapter 4. What can we learn from Nehemiah? Well, here's a few things I've thought about. Nehemiah responded immediately to the efforts of opposition. You know, and maybe that seems like a minor point, but the more I've thought about it, it's like major point here. I mean, when there was opposition, he didn't sit back and see if they would go away, you know, and wait a while and see how this all shakes out. He dealt with it straight on. Face-to-face, so to speak, you know. And, I mean, you got to think, the opposition could have brought the work on the wall to a stop. It had before. It would work again. But the difference here was Nehemiah. We've talked a lot about leadership as we've looked at the story here of Nehemiah. And so the question is, well, what's different now? I mean, well, they've gone back to work. What's different now than in the past when the building of the wall came to a stop? What would you say? How would you answer that? What's different now as to the past?
Their faith.
Their faith, yeah. I think here's a major factor. Their faith is encouraged and it's emboldened. That makes a big difference. What else? Or even why is their faith increased? Go with that some. Why is it different now, Les?
Yes. Unless there's something, you know, stops it.
Yes.
And so once you get people started on a project that they know is an important project, it's what they need to be doing, it's what they have authority from high powers, including God, to do. So they've gotten far enough, halfway, you know, and so they, since they've gotten that ball rolling, it's going to continue to roll.
Yeah. It's going to take quite a force to stop that. You know, I've said sometimes momentum breeds momentum. Have you noticed that? It doesn't matter if it's a personal matter that you're working on. Once you kind of get moving forward with it, you're going to see that thing through. Or in an organization, you know, in a work environment. I mean, sometimes it's the hardest thing in the world to get a group of people all kind of going the same way. You know, but if you can finally ever manage that and everybody's kind of pulling the same way and you've got momentum going, boy, just keep that momentum going. Don't let it slow up. And in fact, momentum seems to breed more momentum. And in the church, it's that way too. Because after all, we're just people. And it just kind of works that way. You know, and if a church loses its momentum and everybody is complacent and just sits back and nobody does anything, it's real hard to get momentum going, get moving forward. But once it gets going and if people truly get involved and encouraged, you know, that momentum just kind of will keep going. I mean, Nehemiah still had to lead. What would have happened if Nehemiah didn't lead? You're going to lose momentum. There has to be leadership. And Nehemiah was providing that. And that's why it worked. Neil?
I remember correctly, the first effort to do the work, there was a shakeup in the overall power structure as far as which country, who the leadership was going to be at the top.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. They questioned, they forgot to lean on God.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, here's our ultimate authority to do this.
Mm-hmm.
And things probably wouldn't work out like this was.
What got the momentum going for them, for Nehemiah and those? What was the source of their momentum? We've mentioned already their faith, this direction from God. They got refocused on a Godward attitude. That's what provided their momentum. Nehemiah, I'm not taking anything away from Nehemiah, but he was an important player in that. But what he did was help them refocus on what God really wanted. I mean, their real momentum was in their faith, as was mentioned. And sometimes we just have to keep that out front. Good point. Yeah. Again, as Paul said in Romans 8, if God is for you, who can be against you? And that was Nehemiah's attitude, Elisha's attitude. It's got to be our attitude as well. You know, we've got to have that focus. Yes.
You have an individual or individuals who are exercising great faith and acting upon that faith, and I think that is contagious to
sure.
those who are witnessing it. And,
that's right.
And on the other hand, a lack of faith can also be contagious.
That's right. It's a momentum stopper. You know, we see that in churches. You know, good thoughts. Nehemiah responded immediately to the efforts of opposition. And I want to make an application here, you know, to the church, to disciples of Christ. You know, there are dangers that from time to time come upon the Lord's church. I say from time to time, it seems like all the time. You know, but there are times that we face greater dangers than others, where Satan is square in our face, individually or even collectively. Churches sometimes, you know, face issues that are uncomfortable and difficult. And we have to choose. How are we going to deal with that? You know, and so often I'm afraid, you know, that there are churches that just kind of step back and maybe it'll go away. You know, if we just leave this alone, they'll get tired and they'll leave. Sometimes preachers. I've said this before. It's easy to get up and preach a lesson that you pretty well feel everybody's going to agree with. You know, that's not so hard to do. But when you have to preach something that you know at least some are going to not like or disagree with, you know, that's a little bit harder to do. But you have to do that, you know, because you can't just leave it alone. Elders in churches face this, sometimes constantly. Sometimes elders in churches are dealing with issues that most folks don't even know about. You know, and sometimes I've heard... I've been in situations where I had someone say, you know, the elders just really haven't been doing much. Well, I had a little bit different view of some circumstances and knew that the elders were working constantly on some issues that others had no idea even existed. They were going to learn in time issues existed, but at that point had no idea. Leaders are going to have to step up and get out front and sometimes deal with opposition right out front. That's what Nehemiah did. And there's some lessons for us to learn from that. I want to say a little bit more on that, but our time is about gone here. And so I think we're going to stop right there. We're stopping a couple minutes early, but I want us to spend a little bit of time on this next week, Lord willing. We're kind of on this point. Nehemiah responded immediately to the efforts of the opposition. And so I want you to look at this question in red. What are the dangers that might come against the Lord's church? You know, what must leaders do? Would you think about that a little bit? You know, take this, write some notes. You know, Rick does the same thing. He makes out a worksheet for us to kind of go through. And Rick and I both don't always go exactly by the worksheet. It's a guide. It's a study guide is what it is. And if you take the worksheet and you kind of study through it, you'll kind of know where we're going in class, even if we don't follow it point by point. And this is a point I want us to spend a little bit of time on. And Lord willing, we'll get to do that next week. Thank you for your good comments. Lesson six, I have done. I just don't have it printed out. I'll try to have that back here on Wednesday night so you can pick that up, because we should get into that next week. Again, thank you for your comments. If you can, move up here close to, stay up close to the front today. Thank you.